Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for a solid hour of Tea Party Power. And now, here's Al Gore's Midnight Massage Man, Mark Gillar.
Hi, this is Mark Gillar, and you're listening to the Tea Party Power Hour. My special guest today, Steve Gorham, the author of Climatism, Science, Common Sense, and the 21st Century's Hottest Topic. He is also the executive director of the Climate Science Coalition of America. Steve, welcome back to the show.
Good morning, Mark. Great to be back.
We enjoyed your visit last time, and now you have this new wrinkle in your resume. You are the executive director of the Climate Science Coalition of America. Tell the listeners what that organization is, what its mission is, and so forth.
Thanks, Mark. Yeah, CSCA is an independent, non-political association of scientists, engineers, energy experts, and concerned citizens focused on informing the American people about the realities of climate science. And we are essentially a grassroots organization trying to get out and talk to people all over the country. And we stick to the science and the economics, and we avoid support for any political party. And we're trying to gather folks that think that we've had enough of this climate change mania and want to move forward with proper measures to take care of our planet and proper economic policies.
Well, you mentioned taking the politics out of the global warming mania. Can you take the politics out of this any more than you could take the politics out of abortion or take the politics out of gun control?
Well, we're trying to do that. We'll see how well that works. But, on one side we have the skeptical scientists. Some of them are calling this a scam and attributing all sorts of evil intent to Mr. Gore and other folks. And on the other side we have the climate alarmists that call the skeptics deniers and a lot of other crazy names. And we don't think that adds anything to the debate, adds anything to finding out what's really going on with our climate, and so we'd like to take sort of a middle-of-the-road approach on that, but stick to the real science.
So essentially, your organization will accept members who are skeptics, members who are supporters of anthropogenic global warming theory. You're looking for both sides to join this organization.
Well, we think that the effects of man-made global warming are very small. So let me shade that a little differently. I think we're scientists that may be liberal in other outlook, maybe Democrats or in favor of government active policies. That's fine. What we're looking for, their point of view though, needs to be that climate change is due to natural cycles of the Earth, not man-made greenhouse gas emissions. But as far
gotcha.
As political affiliation, that's not an issue that we're really concerned about.
Okay. Now, you mentioned that you don't offer support to any political party, but obviously support from political parties has been a big part of the climate change mania, if you will. There's been a tremendous amount of funding that supports the alarmism side, while virtually no funding or very little funding supporting the skeptic side. There's much made out of the $30 million that ExxonMobil invested over a couple of decades, but very little said about the enormous amount of funding that the government provides. I know Joanne Noba wrote a piece on it, but it would seem that if you're in this and you're in this for the money, the alarmism side is the side to be on. Has that always been the case, where it's easier to get funding if you are supporting the anthropogenic global warming theory?
Well, I think that's been the case at least since 1990, when we've seen the tremendous ramp. And I think estimates are about $5 billion now that is U.S. government funding for climate science, and most of that is for proposals written from an alarmist point of view. And in addition to that, we have about $20 billion being spent each year by a combination of federal and state governments in support of renewable energy and fuels to subsidize those. So that's become a very, very big government-supported business and movement.
Was the lopsided nature of the funding even the case during the George W. Bush administration?
Well, there was quite a ramp right about year 2000. The funding went up by about a factor of 10 over 4 or 5 years, and that was so that was the end of the George W. Bush and the beginning of the Clinton years.
Okay. I was not referencing Herbert Walker Bush. It was George W. Bush.
Oh, I'm sorry. The first Bush. I may have confused those. Excuse me.
That's okay.
But the ramp occurred mostly during the Clinton years, and then it was maintained during George Bush the Younger.
Wow. It's interesting for all the books by Chris Mooney and all the articles suggesting that, you know, George W. Bush was trying to hijack science. It seems like the funding for the alarmist side continued under his administration.
Well, it certainly did, and I think our last President Bush was not really sure about the climate situation. He did not like the Kyoto Treaty. He thought that was a bad deal for America. He was quoted as saying that. But nevertheless, he did think that voluntary efforts by industry were the right thing to do. And it's just been in the last few years, I think, that more and more science is showing that natural cycles of the Earth, ocean currents, effects of the sun, effects of weather are dominating our climate, and carbon dioxide is a very small factor.
I want to get into that in just a minute, but I want to stick on the funding issue for just a moment. I am of the opinion, Steve, that there is no way that we are ever going to see balance with regard to this issue in the media, in the halls of academia, if there is not balance in the funding, in that a scientist can write a proposal, a grant proposal for either side of this issue and have equal opportunity to gain access to those funds. I don't see how we will ever, ever have true balance if the funding balance isn't there. So I'll ask you the loaded question of, how can we create that? What can we do when we get a person in the White House who's favorable to seeing balance come into play? What can we do to see that that balance in funding takes place?
That's a good question. I'm not sure I have the answer. I do think part of the solution is to get some of the major scientific organizations in the United States to take a different position. They all currently support man-made global warming as their official statement, although some of those are being reconsidered. There's now an open question in the, I think it's the American...
Geological?
The Chemical Society right now, I think, is looking
at
that. Has put out a letter and a question to all their members to see whether they ought to revise their statement. But until we get some of the major scientific organizations to take a less alarming position on this, I think it's going to be difficult for the situation to change.
Well, I'm not a scientist, but help me understand the dissemination of funds. Where are the grant requests going? Who's reviewing them? And who's making the final decision on this?
And again, I'm not an expert in that area either, but my understanding is that most of the research happening now is government-directed research, which means that people write proposals and submit them to the Energy Department or the government for funding, and then that funding is those proposals, certain ones are chosen, and those are approved, and the ones that are being chosen and approved right now are supporting the alarmist point of view. Basically, they are they start with the assumption that man-made global warming is the primary driver in climate change, and so people are writing proposals to get funding to study animal species or ice melt or effects on agriculture or drought and all those sorts of things based on that assumption, and then those are granted. So we have billions of dollars going out to study directed research saying that based on man-made global warming.
So basically there isn't a whole lot of research being done anymore to support the theory of anthropogenic global warming. They're almost taking a the science has settled, a la Al Gore type approach to this. But you bring up an interesting point because you mentioned that people are looking at the impact on agriculture and looking at the impact on various species. The gravy train is really so good that people who have traditionally been in non-climate related areas are jumping on board to try to get their piece of the pie. And, you know, if you want to do a study on the mating habits of frogs, the odds are you might not get your grant because it's not a very sexy topic, no pun intended. But if you want to do a study on the mating habits of frogs as impacted by global warming, your chances of getting that grant greatly increase, do they not?
Well, that's true. And another thing that I think needs to be pointed out is that there's very little government dollars to find out what is really going on with the climate, to study the feedbacks, to study the carbon cycle and say, what is the real carbon cycle look like, that sort of thing. It's all directed grants based on the assumption of man-made warming.
You've even pointed out in your book that in most of the other books that support the climate alarmism, you have about 10% science in terms of trying to support the argument, and about 90% of the book is the gloom and doom predictions as to what will happen if we do not immediately take drastic measures to cut our CO2 emissions. Is that pretty much correct?
Right. If you typically read these books, there's a very small amount on the science up front. And then the bulk of the books are on what actions we need to take to solve things or all the doom and gloom problems that are going to occur.
Well, let's talk about the science for just a second. I think in your book you pointed out that the UN IPCC's position is basically based on three assertions. Why don't you go ahead and list those for us and then address them one at a time?
I'm not sure exactly which those were, but one is certainly that the carbon cycle is perturbed, and that mankind is putting carbon dioxide into the atmosphere, and it's causing carbon to accumulate in the atmosphere, and they say for 50% for 30 years, and the other percentages for hundreds of years. I don't believe that's ever been experimentally verified, that long carbon cycle. Many scientists have pointed to past studies when we were tracking radioactive carbon from a nuclear testing and found that carbon cycles were much shorter. Anyway, they say we're perturbing the carbon cycle, and this is causing radiative forcing, and which is warming the Earth. And then finally, that there are potential tipping points that could occur, which such as Arctic ice cap melting, Greenland ice cap melting, which might cause a massive sea level rise.
Well, exactly how much has the sea level risen by historically?
The sea level's been rising. Well, even the IPCC says it's risen about 400 feet since the last ice age, 15,000 years ago. But the recent analysis by Arthur Robinson of the Oregon Institute of Science and Medicine shows a rise of about 7 inches on average per century, and that's been fairly steady for the last 200 years. Before we were using and emitting a lot of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere, and after. And there's, matter of fact, a recent study just came out the other day saying there's been no acceleration in sea level rise.
Are you like me in that when you're watching television and one of these pro-Gore broadcasters starts talking about the horrible pollutant CO2 that you just want to scream at your television? CO2 is not a pollutant. It's amazing to me how many people on the alarmism side, particularly the young people who, have their heart in the right place and are just trying to do the right thing, how many of those people actually get carbon monoxide confused with carbon dioxide and think that carbon dioxide is actually poisonous, it's a pollutant, it's bad for the environment. Dispel a few of those myths for me.
Yeah, well, that is a huge misconception. It's been driven by the media and by the climate alarmists. And, of course, that's resulted recently in the endangerment finding by our Environmental Protection Agency in December of last year that carbon dioxide is a pollutant and must be regulated under the Clean Air Act. And that, frankly, is bizarre. Carbon dioxide is one of the three compounds that's essential for life. The others are oxygen and water vapor. I like what Joanne Nova says, when you look at your dinner table and you look at the cheese and the bread and the meat and everything and the salad, everything on that table requires carbon dioxide to be there except for water and salt. When I'm presenting to groups, one of the toss-up questions I always give them is, what's our largest greenhouse gas? And
I know.
You know, I know you do, but unless someone knows the topic, they don't realize that it's water vapor.
Right.
That about 95% of the greenhouse effect is due to water vapor, and that carbon dioxide is only about 5%. And then if you take the man-made emissions of carbon dioxide, that's only about 4% of that 5%. So we're talking about the man-made effect on the greenhouse effect is only about 2 parts per thousand, very, very small.
Mm.
And then beyond that, the greenhouse effect from carbon dioxide is a nonlinear effect, which means that the first carbon dioxide in the atmosphere has the biggest effect, and then as you add each succeeding amount, you get a smaller and smaller impact. So even that small 2 parts per thousand is smaller if you look at it from an addition to the previous carbon dioxide that's in the atmosphere. So the impact is very, very small, and as Dr. Roy Spencer, who's the chairman of CSCA, of our Technical Advisory Board, has pointed out, weather and clouds have by far the largest impact on cooling the surface of the Earth, much, much bigger than carbon dioxide, despite what you hear in the press.
Well, I think it's interesting to hear you say that the relationship is nonlinear. And for you business majors out there like myself, basically this is kind of the law of diminishing marginal returns as applied to climate science. But at any rate, you've said it's nonlinear, and I'll hear alarmists talk, and not only do they think it's linear, they think it's exponential. So you see opposite sides of this being thrown out there. But
right,
for me,
opposite effect. I mean, there's a whole bunch more about carbon dioxide too. We create it in our bodies, of course,
right,
when we burn sugar, and
mm-hmm.
we exhale a concentration that's 100 times as large as what's in the atmosphere.
Mm.
And so it's the fact that we've now called it a pollutant is really bizarre.
Well, let's talk about a couple of things. It's my understanding that commercial greenhouses, having discovered the benefits of CO2 on plant life, actually pump this stuff in to commercial greenhouses, some of them keeping the parts per million at over 1,200 parts per million, which is essentially, you know, more than three times that in the atmosphere. I find it hard to believe, given how money-driven most corporations are, that they would waste a single penny pumping in carbon dioxide if it were a pollutant.
Well,
it's just,
that is true. It is used in greenhouses. And there are several hundred peer-reviewed studies that show that plants grow faster in the presence of higher concentrations of carbon dioxide. So this is a demonstrated fact. Carbon dioxide is great for plants, yet we have the environmental groups right now opposing carbon dioxide into the atmosphere.
Yeah, I think you kind of pointed out that, you know, environmentalists are sometimes referred to as tree huggers, and I know we don't want to get into finger-pointing and name-calling because your organization is trying to stay away from that, but it's so ironic that a group of people who lovingly refer to each other as tree huggers would be against carbon dioxide, which is so beneficial to trees.
Which is fertilizer for trees.
I don't get it. Now, I know we've been on this for a while, but I want to throw out a couple more things. I believe in your book, you stated that in addition to growing faster, these plants are more resistant to heat. less in need of water. They seem to retain more moisture. Am I correct in that there are, other than just growing faster, there are other benefits as well?
Yeah, that's correct. They do better, and I'm forgetting the scientific term, but the pores on the leaves in higher levels of carbon dioxide don't need to be as large, and then therefore they lose less moisture into the atmosphere, and so they are more drought resistant. In the presence of carbon dioxide, it just is all around beneficial for plants and trees.
I'm gonna throw the conversation into what will seem like a completely unrelated category, but it's not, and that is of type 2 diabetes in human beings. The human body has regulatory hormones and counter-regulatory hormones that affect everything from, you know, your blood pressure to your sugar levels. And in the human body, you have insulin, which is counteracted by glucagon, and those two things sort of working against each other. It's kind of a checks and balance system to keep the sugar level in the human body at about the same level that's proper for human functioning, not too high, not too low. It seems to me, just looking at this from the distance as a non-scientist, when I hear that plants absorb CO2 and that whenever you have a high concentration of CO2, you have a proliferation of plant life, that is one of those checks and balances. If CO2 gets too high, the plant population increases, therefore the Earth's surface ability to absorb CO2 increases, and then things go back into check. I mean, am I way off with this analogy?
I think that's right. That may be a carbon... A negative carbon feedback, if you will, in the carbon cycle. And it is one of the miracles of nature that that animals take in oxygen and exhale carbon dioxide, and then the plants take in carbon dioxide for photosynthesis and outgas oxygen. But it's interesting to note also that the big imbalance we have right now is we have 500 times as much oxygen in the atmosphere as carbon dioxide. Carbon dioxide, a little more out there, is probably beneficial overall for the biosphere and the environment.
Let's go into cap and trade, because one of the things that a lot of us are concerned about is whether or not a lame duck Congress will try to push cap and trade through sometime between November and the end of the year. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that is a concern. I think I believe two weeks ago, Carol Browner was on a Sunday Meet the Press or a different program and mentioned that a lame duck session for cap and trade might be the right thing to do.
Oh, and, really?
Yeah. So we may be seeing that this fall.
So when you've already gone against the nation's wishes on health care and the Arizona immigration law, why not add a third category in climate science and go against the belief of the people on that as well?
There were recent comments on the international stage that just because the Senate has stopped cap and trade temporarily, that would not impair the U.S. negotiating position at the upcoming Cancun conference in Mexico. So it's very clear the current administration tends to go forward with policies such as cap and trade whenever they have the chance, and we may see things that are outside the bounds of the Senate, as a lame duck situation might be, similar to what they're trying to do with the EPA.
And is the EPA's regulation of carbon dioxide as a pollutant really their plan B? Hey, if we don't get cap and trade through, then we've got this.
I believe the current administration has said that the proper way to do this is to do it through Congress, but if we can't get a bill through Congress, we'll do it with regulation through the EPA.
One of my guests a few weeks ago was Shannon Gessling of the Southeastern Legal Foundation, and her group has filed four separate lawsuits against the EPA to keep that from happening. So the climate realist, the people who understand the dangers of regulating CO2 in this fashion, are not giving up. I mean, it's this battle is being fought on several fronts, Congress being one, the EPA and the judicial system being another. But it would seem that it would seem that the EPA's potential regulation of CO2 is just a plan B. It's like, okay, you stop us here, we'll go through this back road. I mean, which is kind of scary to me, because it's sort of saying, forget what the people want, forget what the elected representatives of the people want. We're just going to do what we want to do because it's the right thing, and we just haven't explained it to you well enough yet, which seems to be a running theme with this administration.
Yeah, well, it may be a backwards plan, but it could have a pretty heavy impact when it starts January 1st. There's going to be restrictions on oil refineries and restrictions on utilities, and people are going to start to see that. I can't understand the logic of the EPA. When you step back as a simple citizen and say, what is their logic for regulating carbon dioxide as a pollutant? It's obviously not a pollutant in terms of health issues or as other things are, like carbon monoxide. And the only two answers I can see from what they say is that it's emitted by human activities, and it causes global warming, causes the planet to warm up. If we take a look at an eighth grade chemistry equation for combustion in oxygen, very simple, and I was not a chemistry expert, but fuel plus oxygen emits two products at the end. One is carbon dioxide, but the other is water vapor. And since we know water vapor is the largest gas in terms of the greenhouse effect, by the same logic that the EPA is using on carbon dioxide, they ought to declare water vapor a pollutant.
Well, one little problem with that, Steve, Al Gore hasn't figured out a way to get rich selling water vapor credits.
Yeah, well, it comes out of the tailpipes of our cars, and it's a greenhouse gas heating the planet. So, you know, this whole thing is really nonsense.
Well, it is, and like you, I'd like to get into, you know, civil conversations with the alarmist, but I have to say this, I mean, global warming alarmism is almost like some kind of sick green religion. I mean, it's been said that the Holy Trinity of the Church of Secular Progressivism is global warming, abortion, and evolution, and I really believe that. I mean, if you dare suggest to some people that global warming isn't real, and I'm sure you've gotten these emails as well, some of the emails that I've received from people, use every four-letter word in the book. It's as if I've spat upon their green Bible or spit in the eye of their green God. They take it very, very seriously.
Well, people are pretty strong on this issue. There's no doubt about that. But I think there are going to be people looking to come toward the correct science. There are representatives in developing nations that have talked to some of the folks in our affiliations that have said, well, you know, we think we'd like to get some money transferred for climate change. We think adaptation is the way to go, but we really can't take that position with the world pushing for mitigation. So, adaptation is the way. Mankind has always adapted to anything that the climate throws at us, and that's the proper way to handle the situation. So if we can get away from the rhetoric and the charged name-calling on each side, maybe we can get to some better policies.
Well, one of the things that Phelan McAleer and Ann McElhaney did that I thought was pure genius is they tried to open people's eyes to the harm that is coming to many people because of this movement. Low-cost energy is without a doubt an integral part of the development of any nation. And you cannot name one single nation on this planet that's gotten to where it is without having low-cost energy available. And I would like to see some of this liberal green compassion for the environment, you know, for the people they say are being damaged, you know, the island, you know, the Maldives and so forth. I'd like to see some of that compassion extend over to the people in these third world countries that are burning dung to stay warm and burning dung to cook their food. That's not great for them. It's not great for the environment. These people are suffering because environmentalists are getting in the way of coal-fueled power plants being built. And I take the position that there is much more suffering going on in the world today because of this movement than there ever could be as a result of the planet's temperature going up 1 or 2 degrees Celsius over the next 100 years. But I know you've studied this far more than I have. Talk to me about some of the things around the world that are going on, some of the people that are being disadvantaged, being held back because of this movement.
Well, I think you're right. There's a thing called the Equator Principles, which is a document that has been in existence for about 10 years now. And basically, the environmental groups have gone to all the major banks of the world and had them sign these Equator Principles, which say that the banks should only lend money to third world nations in an environmentally responsible manner. Now, that doesn't sound so bad, but one of the things that's being pushed is that projects which might emit greenhouse gases should not be lended on. That means coal mines, that means oil refineries, that means coal-fired power plants. And it's actually become the position of the United States government and the government of the United Kingdom and other nations in Europe that these lending practices should, these loans should not be made. A recent example was April. A loan actually did go through to the government of South Africa for the fourth largest coal-fired plant in the world, almost $4 billion. But the U.S. representative, the U.K. representative, three other European nations voted against extending that loan. And the loan only carried because other developed nations outvoted the United States. But it's the position of our government that the people of Africa should not have electricity for their hospitals, for their refrigerators, because it might cause the world to heat up. And, you know, this is what you're talking about. This is really a tragedy. This is a food spoilage issue, a disease issue, a shorter lifespan issue, and all the rest. And I don't think most American citizens know what's going on in this situation. We take our power for granted, yet our government seeks to deny it to those of the developing nations.
Yeah, I've seen footage on the internet of hospitals in third world countries, or little clinics, let's call them what they are, small clinics, that are trying to power themselves with solar energy. And I think if they run the fridge to keep various medicines refrigerated and at the right temperature, they don't have enough power left to turn on their lights or run any of their equipment. I mean, it's just amazing how these people are suffering at the hands of environmentalists, and yet we don't see the same compassion you know, for these people that we see for other groups. It's absolutely amazing. Phelan McAleer and Ann McElhaney have actually gone as far as to say that they think there's some racism in this, and I'll stop short of that, but I thought it was an interesting charge. And I will say this, I think there's arrogance involved. For us as a developed nation, for the UK as a developed nation, for various European countries also developed, although perhaps not to the extent of the United States, I'll just take a jab at Europe, for us to say that these third world countries cannot have access to the same low-cost energy that we used is arrogance and it's hypocrisy. It's sort of like, okay, we're developed now, but we don't want anyone else to have access to the same tools that we use to develop ourselves. I think it's arrogance. But
well, I think there is. I mean, here's one quote from an environmentalist. I don't think a lot of electricity is a good thing. If there's going to be electricity, I would like it to be decentralized, small, and solar-powered.
Oh, wow.
And you know, that's and then there, as you say, that electricity is the foundation of modern society, modern conveniences, the internet, the cell phone, everything else that we take for granted, and to deny it to developing countries is a big moral problem.
Well, I don't think there's anything more ironic or more hypocritical than some of these kids from 350.com or any of these other youth green groups who will fly across the world in a jet and emitting CO2, get off the plane talking on their iPhones, and talking about how electricity is bad and we need to do away with it. Ask any one of them if they want to give up their iPhone. The answer is going to be no. Ask them if they would like to have swam the whole distance. I'm sure the answer would be no. It seems to be, you take a look at Nancy Pelosi, who has to have the big plane to fly home to California, and because the little plane has to make a stop for fuel. All the hypocrisy out there. I mean, Al Gore living in a mansion, having a houseboat, not turning his lights off on Earth Day, riding around in private jets and private limos. I mean, it's amazing to me. You guys like John Travolta trying to get in on the act, even though he owns three huge jet planes. It's amazing how the rules they want everyone else to live by apparently do not apply to them.
Yeah, I think you're right. I don't really want to go much into that discussion, but it's unfortunate that
I like to name names here. I'm not afraid to do that, and I know where you're coming from. You're trying to say, let's stop the name calling. Let me extend an olive branch to the other side, and let's forget about left, right. Let's forget about Democrat, Republican, conservative, liberal. Let's just all get together and look at the science. And
let's stick to the science.
Yeah, and with that in mind,
go ahead.
No, I was going to say, with that in mind, I'll apologize to you for going down that road. I know I told you I'd try to avoid that, but sometimes it's just really hard. I can't stand the hypocrisy involved in this. Now, we've talked about the fuels, and we've talked about how the green alternatives aren't that great. Where wind has been tried, where solar has been tried, where these industries are being heavily subsidized. What's been the impact? I mean, are they shutting down coal-powered plants left and right? What's going on in the countries where they've put this into practice?
Well, there are just as many misguided beliefs, if you will, about renewable energy as there are about climate science. And renewable energy is not a real good bargain. I discuss that in the last third of my book, extensively talk about wind and solar and biofuels. And we've had about 10 to 20 years of experience. Europe has been installing solar plants and windmills, and the United States has been installing wind turbine towers. And we have about 130,000 wind turbine towers deployed around the world right now, and they produce a very, very small amount of the electricity. In the U.S., we have about 0.7% of our total energy is supplied by wind right now. In Europe, it's very small. And as you mentioned, the coal-fired plants, one example is Denmark. Denmark has put up a wind turbine tower, one for every 1,000 citizens. They have 5,200 of them covering their entire country so that you have a great view of a 100 to 300-foot tall wind turbine tower, steel and concrete tower, from every seashore, every road, every farm, and yet they still get 50% of their electricity from coal-fired plants, and they've not been able to close a single coal-fired plant because when the wind doesn't blow, you still need the backup of the fossil fuel, and they have the highest electricity rates in Europe, four times as high as what we have in the United States. There are many, many examples around the world of wind power and how it is ineffective, but yet we continue to subsidize it heavily here in the United States, and it's been promoted as being the answer to our economy, green jobs, and all the rest. Very, very misguided.
Well, one of the things that environmentalists will come back with is, well, oil and natural gas are subsidized too, but they're not really subsidized to the extent that wind and solar are they?
No, it's much smaller. If you look by far the biggest subsidy right now is for wind power. We do have a big subsidy for carbon sequestration for coal, which is another issue being driven by this climate madness, and the coal industry has accepted this as a way to try and save their industry. But it's foolish because it would be very expensive, never be cost effective, and completely adds no value to society. But in short, wind and solar are by far the most heavily subsidized, about on a per kilowatt hour basis, more than 10 times what the subsidies are for oil and gas and nuclear.
Let's take a quick break and recognize our friends at CAGWH, Citizens Against the Global Warming Hoax. This is a public service announcement being provided by the Tea Party Power Hour.
Global warming is a reality, right? Wrong. Over 32,000 scientists, 9,021 of which hold doctoral degrees, recently signed a petition denouncing global warming as a flawed theory. A growing body of scientists agree that the rise in CO2 levels is a natural event and not man-made. Did you know that this hoax will cost us over $45 trillion by 2050? Together, we can stop the global warming hoax. Visit CAGWH.com and get involved today.
Okay, we're back with Steve Gorham, the author of Climatism, and we were just talking about subsidizing the various alternative industries, and you were pointing out that by far wind is the most subsidized industry, yet it doesn't seem to be making a dent in, you know, in terms of the percentage of our overall energy needs that it fills.
Well, I should probably correct that. Actually, ethanol is the number one subsidy. We're spending about $13 billion U.S. and state subsidies per year. Wind and solar is about $5 or $6 billion on that. But from an electricity generation point of view, wind and solar are the highest subsidy, highest level subsidy.
So in terms of total dollar value, it's the biofuels. But in terms of cost per unit of electrical output, it's wind and solar.
Right. That's correct.
Okay. Gotcha. Now, I have to ask this. You told us what percentage of the electricity is being produced by wind. Can you tell us, other than doubling world food cost, what the impact of biofuels has been?
Well, one thing is we're just pouring our tax dollars into it. In the U.S., about 5% of our gasoline right now is ethanol. And we have mandates for blends up to 10%. We're spending, in 2008, we spent $13 billion to subsidize ethanol, combination of federal and state, and just about $1.20 per gallon. That's gone down slightly, but we're still subsidizing over $1 a gallon for ethanol. And ethanol is a very poor substitute for gasoline. First off, it only delivers about two-thirds of the gas mileage of gasoline. So if you took an E85 van that normally got about 30 miles a gallon and you ran ethanol in it, you'd get about 21 miles a gallon. So you lose a bunch right off the bat by putting in ethanol. And then it takes a lot of energy to produce ethanol. It mm-hmm. takes... ethanol can't go through pipelines, so you have to deliver it by truck. You have the farming of the corn and the fertilizer and the tractor fuel and all the rest on a per unit energy basis. The U.S. Department of Agriculture says we get about a one-third gain, in other words, 1.33 units of energy out for every one unit of energy we put in. There are different estimates. Some say that it's actually negative. But if you're generous and you say that and then you combine it with the two-thirds of the mileage, it takes about 4.5 gallons of ethanol to replace every single gallon of gasoline. And it requires huge amounts of land to do that. So it's heavily subsidized. It's a poor replacement. And then, as you say, it's had a big impact on fuel prices. And ethanol is now our largest...
Actually, I said food.
Pardon?
I said food.
Did I say fuel? Food prices,
yeah.
Sorry.
Okay.
Thanks for the correction.
Sure.
Big impact on food prices. We had riots around the world in 2007 and 2008. And ethanol is now the biggest use of our corn. It's bigger than the food we eat. It's bigger than our exports by quite a bit. And we have mandates from the federal government to go much, much higher. It really is it's a crazy situation, and probably we should look toward removing those subsidies and getting back to using oil and gas for our energy needs and using our agriculture for food.
Well, I had the privilege of seeing Lord Monckton speak twice in person, and as he likes to say, we've gone from growing food for people who need it to growing fuel for cars that don't. And I thought he summarized that real well. And once again, speaking of liberal compassion, I just wish we could see some of that green compassion spill over to a family in Mexico or any one of a number of these countries where food riots have taken place. And I would like to see them look at these hungry people who can no longer afford to eat because the price of corn tortillas, for example, has doubled, and tell these people that the reason they have to go hungry is because we're trying to keep the planet from going up in temperature by 2 degrees Celsius over the next 100 years. I would love to see some of that compassion spill out to these people. I would love to see an environmentalist try to make that argument to one of these families that can no longer afford to eat.
Well, I think that's right. It takes about 9 bushels of corn to produce 1 gallon of ethanol. It's just astonishing, and we have let's see, what point was I after here? Well, let's march on.
One of the things regarding these food riots is that it's the perfect textbook example that we can highlight to demonstrate the media bias in this area. If there were an equal number of people protesting America's military presence in a country or protesting some other American policy that might be labeled a conservative cause, you can bet that these riots would have been front page on America's newspapers. They would have been on the evening news with Katie Couric and other liberal broadcasters. But because these food riots were demonstrating the harm that environmental policies, particularly global warming initiatives, were causing, not 100 years from now, but right now, the liberal press wanted nothing to do with it. Even today as we speak, Steve, one has to search very hard to go on the internet and find articles about the food riots, to find anything on YouTube about the food riots. ABC, NBC, CBS will not touch this. The major newspapers in America will not touch this. These are people being harmed by environmental policy right now so that we can continue on this foolish hope of, man controlling the weather and man reducing the temperature by a couple of degrees Celsius in the next 100 years. I feel confident that you've witnessed the same thing, but talk to me about the media bias that you've observed in terms of how the media covers this issue.
Well, I think that's true. Let me go back and correct something. I made an error on this ethanol. Each bushel produces 2.7 gallons of ethanol. It's a full tank, a 25-gallon tank of E85 that uses 9 bushels of corn. And some folks have said that would feed a person in the developing world for about a full year.
Wow.
As far as the media bias, I do think that's true. People are mixed about renewable energy and even the environmental groups. Many environmental groups are not in favor of the ethanol situation and the support for ethanol. It's pretty clear, studies have shown that producing ethanol emits more carbon dioxide than burning a gallon of gasoline when you go through all the energy that's required to do it. So we have the situation where we're using ethanol, and originally that was meant to stop greenhouse gas emissions and stop the planet from warming up. Now, after study, it's been shown that emits more carbon dioxide. So we have the situation, and the press is not reporting it. The press doesn't really know what to do about the real facts. A similar tangential thing is what's going on with wind turbine towers and the killing of birds, which is
right,
which is a similar thing, and that's not reported either. And many of the wind operators have been effectively exempted from the laws about endangered species and other things, because wind turbine towers kill eagles and kill raptors, mm-hmm, and other types of birds. So there's sort of a mix here. There's such an ideology for behind renewable energy and how it's good and we need to do it, and and it allows people to ignore all the problems like rising food prices and the killing of birds and other sorts of things.
Well, somebody was telling me that a single windmill in California might very well kill as many birds in 1 year as we're going to see dead from the BP oil spill in the Gulf. And yet, if you know a duck or something, not a duck, but you know, if some seagull or something washes up ashore covered in oil, you know, that's going to be on the cover of magazines. It's going to be on the front page of newspapers. It's going to be on the evening news. But nobody wants to go to the foot of a windmill and photograph or videotape a bird that's been killed by a green source of energy.
Yeah, I think that's a bit of an overestimate on that with one windmill.
I forgot who said that. I think it is too. I agree. But, okay, let's say all the windmills in California in the course of a year.
Oh, absolutely.
Kill more birds than we will see in the BP oil spill.
Yeah, we have about 20 or 30,000 windmills in the United States, and in my book, I've used a conservative estimate of one bird killed for every two windmills a year. Some are put that a lot higher, but that's 15,000 birds every year. And
wow.
these are not sparrows. I mean, these are, although it kills a lot of bats, a lot of people say, well, cats kill way more birds. They do, but cats don't kill eagles, and they don't kill hawks, and they don't kill owls. Which these windmills do.
I see my cat Stitch is heading for the door. you reminded her of what she needed to do. I think the media bias is ridiculous. I think just like with the 2008 election, they've circled their wagons. They're saying, damn the torpedoes, full speed ahead with these environmental policies. We don't know the truth. We don't want to hear the truth. And if you tell us, we're not going to repeat the truth. The media is just dyed in green. They support Al Gore. You know, it takes something like a sex scandal to get them to report anything negative on Al Gore, and even then they tread lightly. So I don't hold out any hopes that the Katie Couric's of the world are going to one day wake up and go, wow, all these eagles are dying. Somebody should do something about this. Wow, all these people are rioting. Someone should do something about this because they can't afford food. Oh my, these people in third world countries, they're burning dung to stay warm and burning dung to cook. That's horrible. Somebody should do something about this. You know, there's a long history of liberals not biting the hand that feeds them. You can go outside of the climate arena to see this. I mean, when the Monica Lewinsky thing was going on, the National Organization of Women not only didn't go after President Clinton, they issued a statement of support. When O.J. Simpson was on trial for the death of Nicole Simpson, Tammy Bruce, who was the head of the Los Angeles chapter of NOW, was told she couldn't go out and pursue this as a platform for discussing spousal abuse because African Americans are mainly liberal and we don't want to offend fellow liberals. So even though if conservatives were killing 15,000 birds of prey per year, if conservatives were causing people to burn dung to cook, if conservatives had caused people in Mexico and other countries to riot, you could bet your bottom dollar that Katie Couric would be all over it. But I saw an interview that Katie Couric did with Al Gore, for example. It was a 30-minute YouTube interview, and she didn't ask him one tough question, not one. The only time she came close is whenever she discussed the Congressional Budget Office's estimate of just how much more Americans would have to pay for electricity if cap and trade went through. And I think that depending on, I think the most recent one is what, $1,600, $1,700 per year more. And Al Gore, in that wooden way that he has, stated, well, Katie, now that's about a postage stamp a day. Now, I don't know how much Al Gore is paying for his postage stamps, but that's a hell of a lot more than I pay for one. And
that came from the original Budget Office estimate on the Waxman-Markey bill, which pretty much ignored a lot of different things. It was only direct purchase of carbon price is what that came out to be, 49 cents a day for every American. But they ignored all the other stuff. They ignored government subsidies for all this. They ignored the building of transmission lines for wind towers. They ignored lots of effects like industry moving offshore and and rising electric rates. I mean, they were just they pretty much ignored everything that was going to happen and stuck just to the basic costs.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think to get back to your question, I think the mainstream media does not control the Internet, and they do not control the grassroots avenues of the country. And for your listeners that are educated on the subject, they should be out talking to their local town halls. And I had one woman in Chico, California, who said she bought 14 of my books and went to the city council and gave one to every member and stood up and made her points at the council meeting. And I think that's what people need to do. We need to get out, and regular people need to get educated on the topic and talk about this.
Well, you know, it's interesting because Al Gore, and say what you want to about the left, but they understand how to use, you know, the social media tools that are available to them. And Al Gore, you know, has that organization, I think you referenced it in your book, where they're literally training thousands of people to go out into their communities and do this exact thing, you know, representing the other side.
That's really a sad situation. Same thing with 350.org. All these people that are sadly mistaken and think that we're heating the planet and it's not due to natural cycles. It really is a deplorable situation.
It is, and again, I applaud what you've done with this book, what Joanne Nova's done with her Skeptics Handbook, what Anne McElhaney and Phelan McAleer are doing with their movie, Not Evil, Just Wrong, and all the people who are making that effort. But it would be nice, and I don't know how we could do this, but it would be nice if we could somehow come together and create a similar training process for people who want to represent the other side at their local club meetings, at their local chamber of commerce meetings, at their local city council type meetings. I think we need to have this same level of organization. Now, we've got about 4.5 minutes left. One of the things that you and I discussed in a private conversation not long ago was that we really don't give people who are environmentalists but who do not support anthropogenic global warming a place to go. And I was mentioning that my son and I planted about a dozen or so trees, actually it may be closer to 20, in the downtown area of our community. And it really felt great doing that. And there are people out there who want to... they want to do the right thing. They want to save the earth. They want to have clean air, clean water, lots of trees, lots of plants. And rather than just say, okay, this whole environmental movement is wacko and you don't want to be associated with it because they're all off the mark with global warming, it would be nice to provide people who want to get involved, who want to do good things for Mother Earth, a way to do that without necessarily supporting cap and trade legislation or EPA regulation of CO2. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, I think that is the way. That's going to be the way that that we get out of some of this mess. I think that the Climate Science Coalition of America is trying to do that. We're trying to talk to and appeal to folks on both sides, with the foundation that man-made greenhouse gases are not the driver of climate change. But beyond that, taking not a political position, an independent position, and trying to appeal to folks who want to get back to taking our dollars that we invest in the country and the economy and putting them towards cleaning up a real pollution, real pollutants that are problems, putting into real science research to determine to learn more about the climate, to learn more about other things in our environment, and not going into computer models for making alarming predictions and projections. So I think we're trying to play a role in that area, and open the dialogue and the discussion. We would also like to sponsor some debates. We see very few of those going on across the country. People should be really discussing both sides of the issue in an objective and scientific way. So that's a role we're going to try and play.
Well, let's do three things before we close off the show, Steve. First of all, let's tell people how they can get a hold of your book, Climatism, Science, Common Sense, and the 21st Century's Hottest Topics.
Yeah, the book is at Amazon and at Barnes & Noble, and if you type in climatism, you'll find it. And has a big red sun on the front, should be easy for everybody to see. It's written in a very down-to-earth way. I'm not a scientist. I've written a book based on the work of many, many scientists. I have 1,000 citations in the book, but I've tried to write it in a way for every citizen to be able to read. My wife's 95-year-old Aunt Marge was reading it. She's bought 5 books, and she's chuckling at the middle sections about Al Gore. So I thought that's a pretty good testimony that anybody can read it.
Absolutely, and you know, for whatever this says about me, I am a complete non-scientist. Although I did enjoy my science classes as a high school and college student, and I'm finding that I can understand the science. So if I can understand it, I think everyone out there will understand it as well. But we've got about 35 seconds left to go. Talk to us about how people can join your organization if they wish.
Yeah, please go to our website, climatescienceamerica.org, and take a look. And then if you're interested to have me come and speak, you can get me at my site, which is www.climatism.net.
And we are out of time, Steve. I want to thank you again for being with us, and we'd like to have you back again real soon.
Thanks so much, Mark. Keep up the great work.
Thanks, Steve. You too.
You've been listening to the Tea Party Power Hour with Mark Gillar, a production of the Conservative Broadcasting Network.